You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Today's text is from one of the most neglected books of the Bible, avoided like the plague by any preacher trained to avoid upsetting apple carts. The circumstances of its having been written so clearly parallel our own society that it's hard to spiritualize away its blunt, prophetic words into fluffy, feel-good platitudes. So, Amos is not a book on which you often hear sermons. Part of the reason it's avoided is because it hits a little too close to home. The folks at the top of Amos's society are experiencing extraordinary economic prosperity, much of which has been made possible by official policies and cultural norms that have systematically disenfranchised the poor and destroyed the ancient Israelite equivalent of the middle class. Amos, who is speaking the words of the Lord, lets the people know that God is totally fed up with them. They're living in this bubble of extravagance, of numbness, and denial. They think they are so special and blithely keep repeating the same old words and actions over and over again, thinking it's going to please God. They are totally oblivious to the fact that what they do and say is, to God, just so much noise.
Our words of wisdom are from Amos chapter 5, verses 21 through 24. I despise your festivals, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the offerings of well-being of your fatted animals, I will not look upon.
Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. But let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
A couple of friends were preparing a roast for dinner when one of them unceremoniously cut an inch off of each end of the meat before putting it in the roasting pan. The friend asked her, "Why are you doing that?" And she said, "Well, that's the way my mom did it." Not satisfied with this answer, the skeptical friend persuaded the other friend to call her mom and ask why she would always cut an inch off each end of the pot roast. The mother said, "That's the way my mom did it." Well, now it was getting interesting. So all three of them got on a call with the grandmother and asked her why she would always cut an inch off of each end of the pot roast. The grandmother just laughed and said, "We used to be very poor and didn't own a lot of cookware. I cut the ends off the meat so it would fit into my only pan." How much of our lives are driven by the tyranny of, that's the way we've always done it, long after the original rationale is irrelevant? It never crosses our mind to question it, until we do. Then we have to make some decisions about how to go forward. Church-going baby boomers spent their early lives dutifully cutting an inch off of each end of our religious experiences. Why? Because that's the way our parents and grandparents did it. No questioning allowed, no inquiry. Religion, faith, church, all of it was totally secondhand. And then, when we started to face the real challenges in life, we realized that what we'd been taught was so shallow as to be toothless. and pointless. In the 1950s, God help you if you were anything other than white, male, heterosexual, and Protestant. And the church reinforced these values. Most Americans practiced a religion that was frequently without serious commitment, convictions, or any real grasp of the radical social justice implications of what Jesus actually taught. In both personal lives and the church, two things were prioritized: success, both numerically and financially, and not rocking the boat. Etiquette demanded there be no critiquing of social norms, and that there be silence in the face of damning social ills. In 1963, when Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested in Alabama, the white clergy scolded him and argued that he needed to slow down and moderate his demands for an end to unequal treatment under the law. In his famous letter from Birmingham jail, he responded with disappointment that the white clergy were being driven more by a fear of cultural rejection than by Jesus' vision of a beloved community. As King said, "So often the contemporary church is a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. So often it is an arch defender of the status quo." Is it any wonder that today's passage from Amos was so often on MLK's mind? "I hate, I despise your festivals, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. But let justice roll down like water, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." In 1965, author Pierre Berton published a book exposing most churches as being primarily about promoting the comfort of their members, blessing the privileged status quo for upwardly mobile middle-class white Protestants, and not really caring about making a tangible difference in the world. He called his book "The Comfortable Pew." And guess what? Little has changed. In fact, by the end of the 20th century, it was hard for pollsters to distinguish the attitudes of the most highly religious people in the U.S. from the worst aspects of American society: racism, anti-Semitism, misogyny, heterosexism, unquestioning patriotism, and rabid militarism. Kristen Cobes Dumez is a history professor at Calvin College and the author of Jesus and John Wayne. She points out that the faith of today's self-identified Christian is more likely shaped by conservative political values than anything Jesus would recognize: racial identity, a sex-obsessed purity culture, and a growing Christian nationalism among them. As Nazi-era German pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer observed of his situation, "Religion has become a superficial garment and not a radical practice that takes the teaching of Jesus seriously." So where does that leave us? The capital C church has been dismissed by millions as an irrelevant social club, and worse, as a danger to the future of humanity. Polling suggests that the attitude of many young people towards the church is outright disgust. Look around. The historic cathedrals of Europe are largely tourist attractions. Across the U.S., church attendance and membership has plummeted, seminary enrollments are down, and because of the toxic political culture of lies and fake news and hate slopping over into our churches, pollsters report that in the last year, nearly 50% of current pastors have seriously considered quitting. And it's not just mainline churches. The Southern Baptist Church, recently doubling down on its trademark misogyny and covering up an epidemic of clergy sexual abuse, has been losing members for 14 straight years. And now, for the first time in American history, the single largest religious group in the U.S. is the nuns. That's the N-O-N-E-S, folks who claim no affiliation with any religious group. And why? They say it's because the church is homophobic, anti-science, anti-woman, and is generally sold out to the status quo. Many pastors who haven't already quit and joined the deconstruction or ex-evangelical movements remain trapped in churches where they're afraid to talk about issues that matter, opting instead for end-time prophecies and a fixation on the sins of others. And this is not a new phenomenon. 150 years ago, during America's so-called Gilded Age, when the things I preach about today were just being introduced in our seminaries and the cover-up in our churches were beginning to take root, Robert Ingersoll joined Amos, MLK, and Bonhoeffer in lamenting, "Not one of the ministers dare preach what he thinks if he knows a majority of his congregation think otherwise. He knows that every member of his church stands guard over his brain with a creed, like a club in his hand. He knows that he is not expected to search after the truth, but that he is employed to defend the creed. Every pulpit is a pillory in which stands a hired culprit defending the justice of his own imprisonment." Look, everything that the hippest of churches have tried, from praise bands to coffee shops to pastors wearing plaid shirts and torn jeans, are just superficial window dressing. They just keep doubling down on the one thing they need to drop: their addiction to the gospel about Jesus. In the end, the best thing you can say about most churches is that if the 50s ever come back, they'll be ready. And I don't know how many more times and ways I can say it. The young people are not coming back. Two generations ago, their parents stopped going to or taking them to church. So they have no background and little interest in formal religion, let alone taking their kids to church. But you know what they do have interest in? Critical thinking, treating others fairly. They want to live authentic and meaningful lives. And as many believe this is the only life we have, they want to make the most of it. They want to be part of a more humane, just, and compassionate society based on reason, experience, and knowledge. And if you visit the website of the American Humanist Association, those atheist devils the evangelical church rails against, you'll read that humanists believe that a commitment to social justice is essential to peace and happiness for the greatest number of people, and that it is a moral failing to stand by while others are denied their civil and human rights. Hey, wait a second. Who is that sounding like? As one of my professors used to say, when you get right down to basic values, Jesus was an incorrigible humanist. Respect for the dignity and equality of all people. Compassion for all people. And a conviction that we are tasked with disrupting forces of dehumanization like racism, white supremacy, sexism, and homophobia. That's not just humanism, that's the gospel of Jesus. And yes, spirituality is an important element, but not the spirituality where you spend all of your emotional and rational energy on believing a predetermined set of answers and practicing an established set of rituals. Amos has told us what God thinks of all that. I despise your festivals, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. The spirituality we need to embrace is the spirituality that is another name for longing, for meaning, connection, empathy, more passion, things that most people have not found in church. But we all have felt it, that occasional glimmer of the transcendent in your life, feelings of awe and wonder, a reverence for the majesty and beauty we encounter in nature, images of the vastness of the universe from the Webb telescope. As our guide Kurt Struckmeyer observes, we glimpse it in a glorious sunset, the deep quiet of a forest, the lights of the aurora borealis, a moving piece of music, a tender moment, the face of a newborn child, or the death of a loved one. It is the sense that in the midst of everyday life, we are standing on holy ground. And if we can get beyond the gospel about Jesus and embrace the gospel of Jesus, the words of Methodist Walter Wink make perfect sense. We're not required to become divine, flawless, perfect, without blemish. We are invited simply to become human, which means growing through our sins and mistakes, learning by trial and error, being redeemed over and over from compulsive behavior, becoming ourselves, scars and all. It means embracing and transforming those elements in us that we find unacceptable. It means giving up pretending to be good and instead becoming real. I, along with Kurt Struckmeyer, and I imagine many of you, have had a lifelong love-hate relationship with the church. It's been both the catalyst for some of our deepest and most meaningful relationships and experiences, and the source of some of the most frustrating and maddening struggles. And the painful reality is this: the disillusion of the church, as most of us have known it in our lives, is now inevitable. The question is, are we going to just throw up our hands and surrender? Or are we going to embrace the reality that people are still hungry for the more that we've come to know in the gospel of Jesus? It's just been suffocated under thousands of years of theological and pious insulation. If you've ever heard any poetry by Dylan Thomas, it's probably "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night." And it's admonition that even in the face of death, it's not too late to rant with fierce tears, not too late to blaze. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. But here's the part that really stirs me up. The wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning. They do not go gentle into that good night. Forked no lightning? Yes! Friends, before the church can become whatever the church will be in a future that none of us can predict, it needs to admit that our words have forked no lightning. More often than not, we seek to avoid the flash and the rumble and illuminating light that the storm of Jesus' teaching can stir up. We opt instead for the saccharine sweetness of gentle Jesus, meek and mild. I have sat with dying friends, clergy mentors, who in their last days have confessed with regret having mollycoddled a whole generation of Jesus followers into living a benign life of worshiping Jesus without taking the risk to do what Jesus actually asked of us. In the words of Dylan Thomas, these were good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced. Well, I, for one, do not want to follow in their footsteps. I aim to rage against the dying of the light. And for me, that means calling out with extreme prejudice the inadequacies of the gospel about Jesus and doubling down on the gospel of Jesus. And what does that look like? It means joining forces with the nuns, the secular humanists, and anyone else who embraces the same values that Jesus embraced and that many churches have betrayed. Going forward, if the church is to exist, it's going to have to change. But fortunately for us, we don't have to recreate the wheel. Jesus has already shown us what being people of the way is all about. We need to get out of our buildings and into the world. We need to recover our prophetic voices for the sake of our neighbors who are oppressed, excluded, and left out. We need to move on from our enslavement to rituals, creeds, and dogma that make no sense in the modern world. And we need to learn what it means to share our lives with not just other people, but with creation itself. Basically, we need to stop cutting an inch off each end of the roast. Harold Beck used to tell the story of how one year the oldest living alumni from BU School of Theology came for alumni weekend. He was 96. They didn't know what to do with him, so they invited him to chapel. And in an unguarded moment, one of the faculty asked, would you like to speak to the students? And he said, yes. And Harold thought, oh, good heavens, he'll be longer than I am. Nevertheless, they draped him over the pulpit, and he looked out at the students and said, I would like to thank my alma mater for setting me free without casting me adrift. And he sat down. Friends, we can be set free. And while it may seem so to some, it is not the same as being cast adrift. In Jesus' call for us to put love first is the challenge, the joy, and the freedom to offer the world what it still hungers for. And we're not allowed to give up until justice rolls down like water and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information, or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.